is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Jim Saras from the Saras Skills Academy, and you're listening to the Hoop Heads podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Learning what kids' life was like off the court and trying to help them in just so many small ways and seeing their appreciation for things.
Dan DeCrane will be starting his third year as the Gilmore Academy varsity boys basketball coach in the 2020-2021 season. Dan has been a member of the Ohio High School Basketball Coaches Association since 2011 and the Greater Cleveland Basketball Coaches Association since 2018. He is a current member of the District 2 Coaches Association after having been a seven-year member of District 10. The Gilmore Lancers earned the 2018-2019 North Coast League White Division Championship, and DeCrane was named the NCL White Division Coach of the Year. DeCrane has been a basketball coach since 2007 when he got his start as an assistant at Archbishop Hoban High School from 2007 to 2009. He then gained additional experience as an assistant coach at St. Edward High School in the 2009-2010 season, an assistant varsity coach and head junior varsity coach at Akron East High School from 2010 to 2011, an assistant varsity coach with the 2014 Division III district runner-up Bishop Hartley High School, and then as a head coach at Bishop Reedy High School from 2014 to 2018. During his four seasons at Reedy, his team was the 2018 Division III district runner-up and the 2018 Central Catholic League co-champions. The Silver Knights compiled a school record 12-game winning streak and earned the program's first Associated Press ranking after holding the number one spot in the poll for two consecutive weeks in January of 2018. DeCrane was named the 2018 Division III District 10 Coach of the Year. Dan attended Archbishop Hoban High School, where he played basketball for the Knights, helping the team compile an overall record of 39-5 during his 2 years as a starting guard. He was a second-team All-District Division II, honorable mention All-State Division II, team MVP, and an Ohio Basketball Coaches Association All-Academic Division II honoree. He continued his playing career at Muskingum University, earning two varsity letters from 2003 to 2005. Dan is an avid volunteer with the Mayfield Lancers Special Olympics, serving as a coach and mentor with their basketball team. Don't miss our Hoop Heads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoop Heads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, and Cavaliers Central with Justin Matcham, our first podcast dedicated to covering the ins and outs of an NBA team. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Reach out to me at mike@hoopheadspod.com. if you're interested in learning more about joining our podcasting team. Be prepared to take a few notes as you listen to this episode with Dan DeCrane, head boys varsity coach at Gilmore Academy in Gates Mills, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the head coach at Gilmore Academy, Dan DeCrane. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Oh my gosh, Mike, Jason, thank you so much for having me. This is truly an honor.
Well, we are excited to be able to have you on. You've been one of our biggest supporters, showing up at our webinars and listening to our episodes and reaching out. And we really appreciate the opportunity to get you on and talk to you about all the things you've been able to do in the game, how you've gone about building your program at Gilmore. And I want to get into it right away by talking to you about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in an athletic family. My parents were both one of nine from big Catholic families from the west side of Cleveland. And my parents settled in Stowe, Ohio when I was 5 or 6, finally moved there long term. And my dad put up a basketball hoop in our newly paved driveway in 1992. And I just, you know, worked on my game all the time then. And then it went to, you know, the Stowe Youth Leagues and the Junior Pro League. That we actually, I'm a Catholic school product, parochial schools my whole life. So Holy Family actually had a team. So we practiced, I remember, and I'm sure the gym's hopefully changed, but Fish Creek Elementary School had what is, I thought it was small then when I was 8. So I'm sure it was really small, but just playing and just, you know, loving the game. And then, you know, riding my bike to Silver Springs Park, which everyone in Summit County had to go there to play basketball, you know, when back in the mid 90s, when, you know, going to the park was the thing to do, and just kind of kept growing from there and into the CYO at Holy Family in Stowe, which at the time was, and if it's not, it might still be in Summit County, but it was the biggest Catholic school in Summit County. And they built a beautiful gym. I don't know if you guys have been there, but they have a second floor gym, again, mid 90s. And I just remember watching games in the third grade, because they couldn't play to the fourth in the CYO leagues. Just can't wait to, you know, wear at the time it was like Marigold and black colors and play on that awesome floor. And then, you know, I was really blessed to be coached by really good youth coaches. So in the fourth grade, Mike Dempsey, who had a big family in Stowe, and he actually played football for the Patriots and the Jets in the NFL, I think back in the 70s. And he coached and he was a teacher and a football coach at Uniontown Lake. And I played with his son, Joe, who ended up playing baseball at Butler, you know, as he grew up. But he just, I mean, our practices, I thought, you know, it was normal going forward, like how intense they were. And he put me on top of a very rare 1-1-3 defense that he got from the Hudson High School girls program. And it was just rotating and, you know, pressuring the ball and running passing lanes. And, you know, I just loved, and going from there, we went to, you know, winter tournaments. We went to the Hilltopper down in Valley View for some big tournaments. And then we're going to St. Dominic's and Shaker for, you know, every year. And just all that kind of stuff kept growing. And just kind of my competitive nature took over from there, amongst playing other sports too, obviously.
So talk a little about that multi-sport athlete piece and how important that is to you. And then we all know that there are obviously challenges as a high school coach with wanting your players to participate in off-season workouts and all those things, and the pressure that kids feel today, not necessarily from their high school coach, but just in general from parents and just the way the basketball system is set up. So maybe just talk to us a little bit about how your own multi-sport experience shaped you as an athlete and then eventually shaped you as a coach, and then how you go about handling multi-sport athletes that you coach at the high school level.
Yeah, it was a great question. And it's kind of like a $1 million question too, Mike. And, you know, I kind of felt like I'm in my mid-30s now. So when I was growing up in the 90s, I kind of felt that was like on the edge of, you played a bunch of sports because that's what everybody did, to, no, you start to specialize and you get on an AAU team or a travel baseball team or soccer or whatever it was. And I remember real conversations with my parents about, hey, do you want to play travel baseball? Do you want to play on an AAU basketball team? And I didn't want to give up playing a lot of sports at one time. So I tell kids now in the eighth grade, and families really for that matter, in the eighth grade, I played 5 sports. I played football in the fall. I played obviously basketball in the wintertime, baseball in the spring. I played volleyball in the spring. We had a volleyball team at our school, and we won the city championship, you know, and we were coached by volleyball, former college volleyball players. And they knew the fundamentals, you know, and it was just fun to learn how to jump and, you know, just do different movements. And then I played in a golf league, and I loved every bit of it, you know. And in the summer, I'd play pretty much everything I could. So I learned so much movement and athletic ability. And, you know, growing up, I did Taekwondo for a couple of years. So kind of looking back when I started to get, you know, into high school sports, I saw like, man, my background helped me with all these, you know, agility and, you know, things that you can't really just go out and teach. You have to sort of do. And then I get to coach later on in my life, and I do research, and it shows, you know, not just from a physical standpoint, but a mental standpoint. Successful athletes professionally, they played multiple sports. So, you know, I have articles and data that I present to my families before our season starts every year, you know, of 30 or 28 of the 32 first round NFL draft picks played multiple sports in high school. And there's a less burnout rate. And there's so many positive things from it. And my message to my players is, look, if you want to go play football, go do it as long as you want to do it. You know, it might be for a social thing. It might be for, hey, I just want to play and try something new. Or it might be I really could help out the program. Or maybe hopefully a combination of everything, right? But, you know, you're only a kid once. And I have so many fond memories. My best friends are, you know, guys I played sports with growing up. I mean, there's so much positive from it. So, and the last thing that I tell my guys now is, if you, you know, because right now we're obviously in a unique training period with COVID-19, but I will find a way to get you a workout if you're doing other sports. Like, I will make myself and the gym or a gym available to get better at basketball. Because to me, you know, those are the really special players. The guys that play a lot of things, they love, you know, to wear the name of our school on their uniforms in multiple sports. And they go about and they put work into each one as well. And I think that's where we kind of get lost at is, you know, oh, you're going to get mad if I'm on some summer baseball team. No, not at all. Like, go do that. You know, but just know that I'm always going to be here and find a way for you to also get better at your basketball game. So, you know, I think all those kind of things sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. There's two things that stood out from what you said, Dan, and it's leads me back to a couple conversations that I've been able to have recently with college coaches, and just thinking about, especially at the Division I level, how guys can get workouts in all summer with their coaching staff, and basically those guys are on campus 11 months out of the year working with their teammates and with their coaches. And one of the things I talked to those guys about at the Division I level is it just seems to me like with the level of intensity that's required there, that to be in that environment with somebody coaching you, even through your summer workouts, that the level of intensity that requires, it just seems to me, you mentioned the word burnout, that 4 years of that going 11 months out of the year with no break, I think back to my own experience, and man, that would have been really, really tough to hear those voices the entire season. And then the season ends and 2 weeks later, I start hearing those same voices again. I mean, I needed a break to be able to get away, recharge my battery, to be able to work on my game and do things a little bit on my own. I think that is a factor, and it's probably not as big of a factor in high school, but I do think that if the only thing you're doing 12 months out of the year is basketball, or it's soccer, or it's volleyball, or whatever it is that you do, if you never take a break from it, then you never really long for it again. You don't really ever get that fire burning where you're like, man, I miss basketball. I can't wait to get back. And I think that's something that we run into. And then the second thing that I love that you said is you talked about how if a kid wants to play football, hey, go play football if that's what you want to do. And I think that's where sometimes as adults, whether we're talking about adults as parents or we're talking about adults as coaches, I think sometimes that's what we forget is that really the high school sports experience is supposed to be about the kid. It's supposed to be about the memories that the player makes, not about the memories that the parent makes, or not about the coach's one loss record, although we all know obviously we're judged by that to some degree. But still, I think if it's kid-centered and the kid makes the decision of, hey, I want to go play football, or hey, I want to be a soccer player, or whatever it is, I think as long as the kid is making that decision, then we're going to end up in a pretty good spot. It's when coaches start to force players into making decisions that they don't want to make, I think that's where we get on a slippery slope.
Yeah. You know, to your first point about burnout and get kind of like how your recollection of kind of getting away from the game and doing things, I think there's a creativity piece that maybe COVID-19 was a good thing from an athletic standpoint of I can go in my driveway and work on certain footworks or finishes that, hey, in our high school practices, you know, we just kind of didn't have time to do, you know, right, or we're working on schemes or strategies. So that's super positive. And honestly, I told the guys this. I said, guys, I miss you. I miss seeing you. I miss seeing you in the hallways and at the cafeteria much more than I do necessarily on the court, you know, because you're right. Like, they don't want to always be, you know, hearing Coach DeCrane from the coach. Like, you know, I love them as people just as much as I do as players. And even from a coaching standpoint, and I joke with my guys and say, hey, I watch more in the summertime, I watch more baseball than I do basketball film. And I'm doing a lot of both because it's refreshing and I get to have fun and be a fan and, you know, and cheer. Like, you know, obviously baseball is going back and I'm not going to get into the labor dispute and stuff like that. But
we'll leave that one alone, right? That,
yeah, no kidding. But I'm just pumped that I get to kind of cheer for something and you know, it's healthy. It's mentally refreshing. And to your point too about memories, I mean, shoot, I probably got into coaching, especially at this level, because of what it's like to live in a school environment that's supportive and the memories you make with friendships and the guys with high school basketball with were at my wedding. I mean, I can go on and on about that. And that's the big picture of it. You know, I'm not going to take away someone's opportunity to run out and play Friday night football in Ohio if that's what they want to do. I mean, heck, they make movies about those kinds of things, right? I mean, so no, you're 100% right, Mike. That's great.
All right. So going along with that, talking about it being kid centered and talking about getting kid an opportunity to be able to run out and do those things, what's a memory from your high school career that stands out to you when you look back on your time as a high school athlete? Maybe it's even in a different sport than basketball, but just what's one or two things that stand out about your time as a high school athlete?
Yeah. So I think just not to go back for just a quick moment, but I think I love my high school experience so much because of what my dad showed me. He opened the door to high school athletics. I love sports, but he took, I mean, every, you know, I would say from fourth grade, fifth grade on, every Friday night in the fall, I was at a football game. And I wasn't, playing tag football behind the bleachers or chasing some girl or going to the concession stand. I was studying the game. And, you know,
you can actually watch a football game? When you're a middle school kid, you can actually go and watch a football game? I thought that was illegal.
It's funny how attendance has changed, isn't it? And just like, it's nuts. But
yeah. To be fair, there's not kids chasing girls anymore. They're all just looking at their phones the whole time.
That is true.
And, yeah. But I don't think that's even just football games. I think that's any sport. If you go watch a middle school sport, because I coach the middle school level. If you go watch a middle school sport, the kids are standing there in the stands watching their friends play basketball, but they're not really watching because they're all on their phones the whole time. Like, literally,
you know, it's
the whole
my
time.
First year coaching as a head coach. I remember watching highlights that kids took of our kids on Twitter, and I'm like, why don't they just watch the game? Why do they, you know, right. I don't even know if they're filming because we weren't very good. But I'm like, this is, you know, it's just it, you're right. It's changed, and I just, you know, what's also changed, and this is my point too, is they miss like when someone, you know, makes a 7-yard touchdown run and the band goes crazy, or. You know, the kind of the fun cheers, the clean cheers of student sections when there's a big momentum swing in a basketball game. Like that kind of stuff it gets lost a little bit, or at least the pageantry. And that's what I was given. You know, I remember watching the Norman, Feldman, Kovach, the Nate Mears of Stowe teams. You know, even though I wasn't going to go to Stowe because I didn't have a choice being a Catholic school, you know, pure thoroughbred, I guess, kind of being raised that way. But I remember Lynn Chapman and Tony Biting, you know, watching the Hoba teams. My dad's a St. Ed's grad. So when they were great in the late 90s, man, we went to like 15 games, you know, and down to Columbus when both Hoba and St. Ed's were there in 98. Like that kind of stuff was so cool to me. So then kind of going in and getting an opportunity to live it in high school was great. And I would say the easy answer, Mike, to my high school career would be playing against LeBron because he's my age and we were arch rival schools. Not that he would have a real collection of me trying to guard him because they absolutely dominated us.
There was that time you blocked his dunk attempt, I remember, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. If you do some YouTube videos pretty closely, I didn't get dunked on, but a few of my good friends and teammates did. But I would say my senior year, what just kind of catapulted me to an appreciation of what I had. So I went from literally at Hoban being the, so I decided to go to Archbishop Hoban amongst the other kind of, you know, Summit County Catholic schools. And I was guy 15 of 15 who made the freshman team. And we had about 50, 60 kids try out. And then I went that same year, I ended up working my way up and I actually played JV. I was just kind of nuts, you know, 3 months later a little bit because I just kept earning my stripes. But, you know, my senior year, we went 20-2. Our only loss in the state of Ohio was to the national champions, St. Vincent St. Mary. And just kind of playing, my last game was at the Canton Memorial Fieldhouse, the epicenter to me of, you know, Northeast Ohio high school culture and feel. It's an awesome gym to play in. The game was sold out. There's people scalping tickets to get in to see LeBron. And look, we lost. We put up a fight for probably about a quarter and a half looking back at it. But just, you know, we went 39 and I think five or six, you know, my senior year, and played with guys that played in college, you know, are coaching in college. Like, just, I just had an awesome time. And I felt so, you know, responsible to kind of carry on a Hoban legacy. And I got to do that when I was a player. And that was really special to me.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think when you can feel a sense of connectivity to your teammates and then to your program and your school, I think that makes it mean even more to you than it would in other circumstances. I think that's one of the things that's odd about, again, today's scenario. Like, I think about myself, grew up in Strongsville from the time I was in second grade. Probably by the time I was in fourth or fifth grade, I probably had a really good idea of who my teammates were going to be. Eventually, when I got to the high school, you could tell who the athletes were, who my friends were. And I never thought about really going anywhere else. And then when I did eventually get to play for the high school, it was just a thrill to be able to suit up and run out. And I always said when I was a kid, the thing I loved was watching the players who were in high school when I was in elementary school and middle school run out and slap the backboard during warmups. And that was the one thing that I always wanted to be able to do, is hear that fight song and run out. And to your point, it's just, you feel that pride, you feel that connectivity to the program that you grew up with, that you were watching. And I think that that's something that I'm sure as a high school coach that you try to develop that same pride in your program and your school and in what you're doing. So I think that's a great way of trying to frame the recollection that you have of your high school career. And thinking back to that time, at what point during your high school career did you start to think about or consider that you might have an opportunity to play beyond high school and maybe get a chance to play some college basketball?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I played for TK Griffith, who I think is going into his 28th year, and I just really believe he's one of the best in the state of a program builder and a people builder, and let alone a great high school coach. And we were at a shootout going into my senior year at the College of Worcester, and I remember him kind of having these conversations with me after one our first game. It was a Saturday morning, one of those. There's 30 teams there, and you know, you play a game and you go find some hallway or stairwell to sit at and talk about it. And he grabbed me after one and was like, "Hey, do you think, you know, would you want to keep playing college basketball?" And I'm like, "Well, I played, you know, I started as a junior and I averaged like 5 points, 6 points a game. And I kind of was responsible for guarding the other team's best player and kind of, you know, not really scoring. But I had a good summer, and I think he started to see that. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I never really think about it, but that'd be a great goal of mine. A long-term goal I had, I guess. And my dad and I kind of were poking around to see if I maybe would have an opportunity at a Division III school. So he started, you know, reaching out to other coaches. And I remember I got a call from an assistant coach, and I don't recall his name, from Grove City College. And I'm like, wow, like, that was pretty cool. And then, you know, put a ton of time in, and the fall came. It was going back to high school story, you know, memories. Our football team, which I had a lot of great friends on, went to the Final Four, and this was the fall of 2002. And just, you know, seeing that, and then the day they lost, we played the next day. So we didn't have any, ironically, we had like one, I think, you know, maybe 10th, 11th guy on our football team. So all of our basketball guys were ready to go. So I remember we played at Akron Garfield the day after we lost the football Final Four. And it was Thanksgiving weekend too, because I remember our football team played the day after Thanksgiving, and then we played the next day. And I had a really good game. But, you know, I don't know how many points I scored, but I had my career high. And then the next game we played at CVCA, and I'll never forget. I walked out of the gym. I think I went like 14 or 15 from the line. And someone's like, "Hey, how many points did you score?" I'm like, "I don't know. I kind of had a lot. I had like another career high, you know." So I think this kind of kept going from there. So I had a great month of December, and then I was fortunate enough to play with Tommy Heil, who went to Bluffton, and he's now the head coach of Bolton Wallace. Him and I were backcourt mates, and we had another great guard who was one of the most underrated guards for a couple of years, because, you know, we were overshadowed obviously by a lot of good teams in the area. But June Wilder ended up playing. I think he had a couple records at Akron Wayne for a few seasons when he played there. He actually went with me to Muskingum. And so how I got there was you know, a couple colleges basically started to see me a little bit because they were recruiting other players that I had a few good games and they kind of kept carrying over. And then, you know, I guess to answer your question before I kind of go forward, Mike, is before my senior year, I think Coach Griffith sort of forecasted like, hey, maybe this could happen. And then it started to really happen. And then, you know, I started to get some interest from a lot of Division III schools.
All right. So how do you make the decision to go to Muskingum? And then what's the transition like for you going from high school basketball to college basketball?
Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, maybe why I'm here, because I love the game so much and I love competing and everything that goes into it that we already had touched on. And it kind of came down to, so Muskingum recruited me pretty consistently my second half of my senior year, made a couple of visits down there. I had some interest from Mount Union. I had some interest from Case Western, who really wanted Tom Heil, our point guard, and they were right because he was way better than me. And I just kind of felt a better fit basketball-wise at Muskingum. You know, whether it was personnel or just the program itself. And it was a small school, and I kind of in a really rural area. And I didn't mind that. That didn't really bother me. I felt like I could maybe find myself there. And they had my major, too. They had just started a criminal justice program. And my lifelong goal was to become like this missing persons FBI agent. And I'm like, oh, man, I could just kind of make all my goals kind of happen at one spot.
Nice.
So I ended up choosing Muskingum kind of, you know, early April, maybe in my senior year. And I quickly realized the big jump that it is from high school basketball to college basketball. And I would consider myself an overachieving high school player. And I was probably the beneficiary of playing around with some pretty talented players. We started three guards, but, you know, they created so much for me to do things. And we, you know, we pressed a lot. We had a lot of possessions in our game. So we kind of scored the basketball a good bit. And all that kind of stuff. So then I go and, you know, I'm 6'1" and a half, 160, going to college open gyms in June. And I'm like getting my, you know, my tails on the ground pretty quick in a lot of those games. But, you know, so seeing that, I saw what I had to do, you know, to compete going forward. And then, you know, Muskingum was, it was a great experience. And I didn't know it at the time because I didn't get a chance to, you know, I'll be honest, I don't think I earned a chance to really get a long look playing, you know, at a high level there. So that kind of, you know, sort of uniquely changed my route, so to speak.
All right. So you start to see that your playing career is maybe not going to continue for as long as you had hoped it would. And so at that point, clearly on your way into college, you're thinking about criminal justice and being an FBI agent. Was coaching at all on your radar growing up, and as you went into school, was it something that was in the back of your head, or was it something that when you started to see that, hey, my playing days are over, now maybe I need to start looking for an opportunity to stay in the game because I love it so much? How did you come to the realization or the thought that maybe coaching is where you wanted to end up?
Yeah, so I made an interesting college choice. So my second year at Muskingum, my sophomore year, you know, rarely got off the bench, played with some great players. If I would have stayed there, I would have been coached by guy and playing with guys that are coached, still coaching in college. And then Gino Ford took so I played for Jim Burson my last 2 years. And it was looking back, the schemes, the Princeton offense, like I got to like live every day because that's what our identity was. We were Princeton offense. He was kind of the mastermind that unlocked that key, you know, in the early 90s and, you know, kind of kept going forward after Princeton made their great runs with using that system. And, but to kind of answer your question, I see myself as I'm not going to play, you know, I'm just not. And you know what? I'm not very good. I think all players, they overvalue themselves to an extent. And looking back, I did. And that wasn't that I couldn't be on the roster and certainly, you know, keep competing, but I just wasn't that good. And I always thought about coaching, and this is a great question you asked me, because about 2 years ago, I opened up my senior yearbook, and in the back 10 years from now part, it put FBI agent and finding time to coach on the side. And I never knew I wrote that until I opened up.
That's awesome.
I moved back to Northeast Ohio. I found a box that had that yearbook in there. So I always loved the game. And at Muskingum, you know, Jim Burson and his son Jay, they had all these connections. You know, a lot of my teammates went on to be GAs and coaching in college, and, you know, Cole Pittis and, you know, Kevin Sapara was a GA at Cleveland State. And there's just, you know, and then there's other high school coaches. Jeremy Adey is the coach at Navarre Fairless, and DJ Schrock's the coach at Chippewa. And now Kevin's the coach. He's the head coach at Strongsville. So, like, I'm like looking back, I'm like, man, if I would have stayed there, my coaching path could have been so much different. So I end up deciding to pursue my first professional dream of being an FBI agent. So I transfer to the University of Dayton, who boasted the number one internship program for criminal justice majors in the country. You know, and I went on a campus visit, loved it. You know, great. This is what I'm going to do. So oddly enough, in the summers, I go back to Hoban and I work their camps, but I coach their JV summer league for 2 years and loved it. Right. So kind of like, this is cool. Then at Dayton, I finish up my last year. I room with the Farrell brothers, the twins. One's the manager at Dayton, who now is one of their assistant coaches after he went kind of all over the country coaching. The other was the JV assistant coach at Springboro while we were living together. So I was always around basketball and I loved it, you know, and you know, I kind of get done graduating and then I realize, okay, to become an FBI agent, you know, there's, and I did a lot of internships and, you know, there's a lot of bureaucratical steps. There's a long time where you become like a, you know, the detective piece. And in 08, which is when I kind of graduated, that was the recession. There's a hiring freeze by the government. You know, and then on top of it, I'm like, I don't even like to have a gun in my hands. Like what am I doing? You know, so I took a couple jobs after college, but I always found roles to coach. And I think my calling came, and I remember vividly, it was mid-November of the fall of 2007. I was graduating that December. So after I transferred, some of my credits didn't equivalate right away at Dayton. So I did a lot of internships, and I get a call from Tim Lucy, who is the JV, he was the JV coach at Hope and my JV coach. He was the head coach at Chippewa 5 years, kind of, you know, late 2010s or 3 to 5 years later on. Anyway, he's having triplets and he's like, hey, just to let you know, I know you're graduating in December. You know, I'm not sure if you have a job lined up or anything, but my wife and I have triplets. I'm going to have to step away for a while. You've coached my guys in the summertime. And we just feel like, hey, if you kind of come on board, be an assistant, JV varsity. If I leave for a week or so, go coach the team. You know, you're kind of like the interim JV coach. So I wore that title pretty proudly. So I go back, graduate, sub at Hoban while I'm looking for jobs. And of course, you know, TK, we at Hoban, we've always been in the shadow of St. V since the late, you know, early 2000s, late 90s. We go on a tournament run. You know, I coach the JV team a little bit. Of course, they go like 3-0 as an interim coach. Like, love that. We beat St. V in the district final in Canton Fieldhouse. You know, go on to the regionals. I'm like, what am I? This is my calling, right? I'm gonna go back and teach and coach. And I kind of started taking steps after that to do that route.
All right, that is a great story. I love it. I love the fact that you got to go back to your alma mater and you got hooked immediately by it. What was something that when you went back, because obviously, especially when you go back, and this is a question that I always find fascinating, when you go back to the same program that you played in with the same coach who was once your head coach, and now you are a colleague of his rather than a player of his, what was that experience like? What was something unique, different that you didn't realize behind the scenes went on from a coaching standpoint while you were playing, you had no idea the coaches were doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Excellent question. So there's so much planning and preparation and trying to read the minds of teenagers. So I felt like I was maybe an oddity looking back, where I was going to do anything that coach told me to do. And of course, I admired him wholeheartedly when I played for him, but just in general, like, I'm going to run through a wall for Hoban basketball. Well, not a lot of people are like me, you know, and even today. So it's finding ways to kind of get to the core of kids and to get to us. And what was, you know, challenging for that 08 team is we had a lot of talented players at Hoban right there in that period. They were, a lot of them were big time non-basketball players. We had a kid get drafted by the White Sox after he went to Kent State to play baseball and pitch. And then we had a player who went to play football at Akron. another played football at another college. So we had a lot of athletes. So TK the whole year is trying to find, you know, and this is how I kind of approach every season too. It's about how your puzzle pieces fit. You have a bunch of puzzle pieces and you got to get them to fit. And every year that puzzle changes, you know, it's, you get new guys. So I think just trying to find that hole every year, you sort of have to reinvent yourself. And maybe at a program like a Hoban where you're 9 through 12, and that's majority of the places that I've coached at, you know, as well. Every year, you're kind of reinventing yourself to an extent. And I think TK did an awesome job of that, you know, looking back every year. And it's not just showing up and thinking, oh, all these guys, we're going to work hard, we're going to be together. You have to find a way to get to us. And he always found a way to get to us.
So what did you have to do in order to be able to switch from being a criminal justice major to be able to be a teacher and get your start in that on the professional side of it?
So I ended up going back to school at night. So I took a job in the private sector in Beachwood at a private background screening company. I felt I owed it to myself to try to explore the career a little bit while I wanted. I knew in my back of my mind, I'm like, okay, I just finished, you know, sort of going through my undergrad years. Now I, you know, let's see what this is like. Maybe I can do both. Maybe I can coach and go into this field. And that certainly wasn't the case. I didn't want to be at a desk, a cubicle. I wanted to be, you know, in something I love to do. And I think so many people in life they spend years finding out what they really love to do. And instead of going out and doing it. And my dad, who was a successful business person, always told me if I could do it all over again, and he played college football at Denison, he's like, I would have gone back and taught economics and business and coached football. I'm like, you know what? I'm 22, 23. I need to start doing that. So I started to research a master's program that I could teach in social sciences, because that was, you know, mainly criminal justice curriculums built up of political science and criminology and sociology. So I researched a couple of master's programs. Notre Dame and Providence had an ACE program, they called it, where you kind of went did some social justice work. And that was actually going to take a lot longer. And then actually Kent State had a master's of arts in teaching program. So I met with their director. This would have been the spring of 2009. And I had to get some prereqs done. So I was still working full time. And I ended up getting my classes done at Tri-C East, actually, because it was right down the street from my office in Beachwood. So I did classes there, and then I continued to coach in the evenings. So I started, since I was working more in the Cleveland area, I started to expand my coaching kind of realm and looking at different programs to coach with as well. So I started going back to school at nights. So I was working full time, back at school at nights, and then trying to find time to coach too.
All right. How does the opportunity come about that you end up at Ed's for a year?
Great. So all about connections, which is so much about life. So I worked at an office building, and across the hallway was a St. Ed's grad, Bob Andrews, who Lakewood guy, and he played at Ed's. He also played football, I believe, at Bowling Green. My dad's a St. Ed's grad. And, you know, just through talking with people, they're like, hey, I'll reach out to Coach Flannery, you know, see if he'd, you know, welcome you to his staff. I'm like, you know, it's not bad. That beats the 50-minute commute I'd have to make at Hoban. So it put us in contact, and, you know, what a great guy Eric is. You know, we'll listen to anybody who reaches out to him. And I sat down in his office. So I'm looking at all these NBA and college jerseys that will admit, you know, Wake Forest and North Carolina, Joe Williams. I'm like, man, this is pretty cool, you know. And he's like, well, I don't have any paid positions. And not that I was looking for that, but he's like, how about an assistant freshman job? And I'm like, sounds great. Sign me up. So while that job occurs, I end up taking another part-time job as a probation officer in Rocky River. So while because it was more adaptable to my school schedule at Kent State. So at that time I got to Kent State too. So I start to go to classes in Kent State, work in Rocky River, coach in Lakewood. And I was still living at my parents' house in Stowe at the time. So I was kind of doing some good around trip work and
putting some miles on the car.
Putting some miles on the car. Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? What was nice is, you know, I was the assistant freshman coach, and I love that role, you know, acclimated those kids to St. Ed's and to high school basketball. But what was also cool was Flannery really appreciated guys that put time in addition to this 4-to-6 practice schedule. So I scouted a lot for them too. And he looked at my notes, you know, and, you know, would listen to me at halftime. Like, would listen to all the coaches at halftime. So he was very open to other people's opinions about things. So I kind of felt, you know, empowered and like, hey, I'm truly helping the whole program as much as I can.
All right, I'm jumping ahead here, but I think this is a good point to ask you this question. So when you're at this stage of your career, you are not married, you don't have your three children, which you have today. So clearly the amount of time that you have available to you to be able to go from your day job to your volunteer coaching job to your scouting on Friday night to all these other things, clearly that's a time in life where you have the kind of time to invest in those opportunities. So just talk a little bit about how you remember those times. Do you even remember them? How much time you had back then? And then maybe just talk a little bit briefly here about how you balance coaching and some of those things that you just described, which obviously you can feel your enthusiasm for those things. And yet you have your family at home that clearly becomes your priority once you have them in place. So just talk a little bit about how you balance family and coaching.
Sure. Oh, I feel like I do a terrible job of it, but I do the best I can. And I think the number one thing is I eventually, you know, married a coach's wife. I mean, to have a healthy coaching life, you have to have a happy wife. You have to find that right person. And ironically, my wife also went to Hoban. And we kind of rekindled after college. So it's sort of during the same time period that we sort of reconnected when I was coaching at St. Ed's. That was actually my first year we started to date. And in fact, I remember her being at – she was a nurse at the time in Akron General. And she was one of the assistant coaches and the freshman coach for a year at Hoban for the girls program. And she was at the 08 district final that we won. I just remember these small things, you know, and – so we kind of had that mutual connection there. But I just think coaches are doers. So if you're going to coach, you're putting in additional time to everything that you already do in your life. And I think coaches do a great job balancing that in general. So, you know, I'm cool with a 5 to 6 hour, you know, sleeping pattern during the heart of the season. And even, you know, right now with having three kids, the quietest time in my house is like 9 o'clock at night. So I can get a
we're with,
like
we're
a
with you.
Things done.
We are with you. We are with you 100%, Dan. We are with you on that one.
So, except Mike's quietest time is like 1:30 a.m. So
yeah, the quarantine is getting everybody in my house is now sleeping a little bit later. Although now we're getting back to activities, we're getting up a little bit earlier. But man, our bedtimes are creeping later and later, and I'm as guilty of that as anybody.
Yeah, no, I you know, it's tough. It's been an adjustment, you know, which is honestly, you know, and I'll go back to that schedule piece in a second, but the last 3.5 months have been a blessing because I've been around my kids so much more at a great age, you know, 7, 5, and 3 that I didn't have, you know, and we've done a lot of change in the last 8 years that we'll continue to kind of touch on, but I just, you know, looking back, I felt like opportunities opened up because I kept, you know, saying yes to people. Yes, I'll do this. Yes, I'll do that. Yes, I'm going to, you know, go through and get my teaching license so I can go teaching coach. And, you know, because of that, you got to be pretty tight with your priorities. And I think the biggest thing that I struggle with is making sure that when I'm home, I'm home. And I try not to, you know, put stuff on Twitter for our guys or watch film when the kids want me to, you know, wrestle or play, you know, whatever we're doing. And that's tough. And it's tough during the year when you're trying to be successful on and off the court and make sure your future program's successful. And then you're making sure your kids are seeing you enough. Like I said, I think you got to have the right, you know, co-pilot. And I do.
All right. Excellent answer. And I think it's something that all coaches, if they don't use necessarily the word struggle, I think all coaches wrestle with that and try to figure out what's that balance. Because clearly, if you are a coach, you have a burning passion for your team, for the game, for coaching. And yet, again, we all know that our number one priority is the people that live at home with us that we love and we care about. And it's difficult. It's a difficult thing to balance. And I think it's one of the biggest challenges that we have in the coaching profession today. As we get more into what you're doing today at Gilmore, we can talk more about this. But just the baseline amount of time that you have to put in as a high school coach today, even compared to 15 or 20 years ago, just to be in the conversation of doing what you're, quote, supposed to do is just, I don't think the average person has a great understanding of how much time a high school coach puts in. But before we get to that, let's just kind of go through the next stops in your career. Talk to us about the two different assistant coaching jobs you had after you left Ed's, and then how you end up getting your first head coaching job at Bishop Hartley.
Yeah, so while I was at Ed's, I was getting my master's at Kent State, and I did my student teaching at Stowe. So I was still working in Rocky River part-time as a probation officer, like I said, but I kind of felt I really wanted a different coaching environment, different experience. So I started to consult a few, mentors of mine, TK being one of them. And I'm like, what if I just go in the city? I grew up in the suburbs, primarily Caucasian population. And I want to immerse myself in something that's different. And I want to learn about different types of people. So he was, colleagues, I guess not, we would call them friends, but knew Ross Ferrello really well at Akron East. And I don't know if you guys know Ross too well, but Ross is, roll up your sleeves, old school, disciplinarian, but loved the kids. Wasn't, supported them wholeheartedly. So he calls Ross Ferrello in the fall. This would have been the fall of 2010. And it was like, Ross, I got a guy. I think he could help you out. I don't know if you're looking for somebody. So immediately, I get this call from this, 330 number. I answer it and, this is Dana Crane. This is Ross Ferrello. And, Ross is, 5'7" and, but his demeanor is he's 6'9". He's kind of like all into this conversation. And I'm like, oh, it's great. Coach Ferrello, I appreciate the opportunity. Can we talk? And sure, what's good for you? And so I meet with him and he definitely didn't smile at me in our conversation for the 45-minute interview we went on. And after a while, I'm like, I just want to help out. I just want to help your program. I got a little bit of a calling for this right now. I don't know if I'll be here next year. I have no idea what's going to happen in my future, but I'm committed to you. And they went, they had just come off back-to-back district champions and one being in Division I, and they lost to Jackson in 2010 and who by two in the regional semis, and Jackson won it all. So they had a good pro. I mean, he was doing great things. So he took me on, and I ended up getting the JV job because of some coaching changes that had happened right after I got hired. So I was his assistant varsity and head JV coach. And I got so much out of that experience, probably more so than the kids got. And probably him for that matter. I mean, learning what kids' life was like off the court and trying to help them in just so many small ways and seeing their appreciation for things that in a lot of my, background, I didn't see that as much. He had snacks in the coach's office that he would give to kids after every practice before they got on the city bus to drive to get home. We went out, a donor took us to Luigi's Pizza that the kids, I guess it was an annual tradition, like, kind of towards the end of the season. I drove kids home that day in a snowstorm, and I just had a great, experience just learning about them and just seeing their background. And I always joke with Ross too, because he won three districts in 4 years. And the one year he didn't, I was on his bench and we got upset in the first round. So I knew that I didn't bring him a lot of luck, but I got so much out of that experience. It was great. And then from there, I graduated with my master's, and I was serious with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and I'm just like, hey, Katie, I want to make the state of Ohio my search ground, because at the time, social studies teachings were a hot commodity. So I made my umbrella right before you did everything. There was a lot of emails applications, but I did a lot of hard copies at the time still too, because you could do it back, 10 years ago, surprisingly. And I got one call, and it was from Bishop Hartley. Didn't know anybody there. I knew one of my good friends now was an employee of the Columbus Diocese. I have no Columbus ties. So they called me for an interview. I go, yeah, I mean, why not? What do I have to lose? And I did some, more research on the school and the program. And first interview went well. Second interview went really well. And they said, well, if we're going to hire you, I want you to coach, and they just came off a Final Four run too. And they lost to St. V in the Final Four that year in Division II. So I met with Randy Quartercracks, who I think he's like second in rebounds at Findlay, University of Findlay, and second in points. I mean, his dad is obviously the legendary coach at Kaleida. And, just a a mountain of a man. I mean, the guy is huge, being such a great athlete too. And he's just like, yeah, I'd love to have you. You know, see what happens with your teaching contract. And they offered it to me. And then sure enough, I get, you know, two more calls from NDCL and another place, you know, I think that was looking for a social studies teaching job. And I was trying to, you know, coordinate that with coaching, but took the job at Hartley and just moved out on my own. Then shortly knew, you know, 2 months later, I proposed to my wife because I wanted to make sure.
She came with you, right?
Yeah, she came with me the next year.
That's awesome.
So for 3 years, I was, an assistant, JV, head freshman. And then my last year was probably my most, you know, valuable as an assistant because I was basically the offensive coordinator. And we had a good team. The school is phenomenal. I mean, they're so successful in a lot of sports. Brad Birchfield is a football coach there. And I learned so much from being around him and seeing what he does. And you talk about a guy that is successful on and off the court, the football field. So we were close. And I, you know, like I said, learned a ton from him. But just learning on the fly of we had a good team and hey, I'm the play caller, right? I'm the puppet master of the offense. And Randy giving me that role was so vital for my development as a coach. And again, the basketball worlds are very ironic, and everything kind of that comes around goes around. So two of our biggest wins that year, Mike, was against Bishop Reedy, who was a league rival. And in that league, there's five teams in the Central Catholic League: Bishop Waterston, Bishop Reedy, St. Charles, St. Francis of Sales, and Bishop Hartley. And everyone's a rival, I think. So we finished second in the league that year, I believe, but we swept Bishop Reedy, who had a really good team. They had eight seniors. They were really talented. Their best player was Josh Gantz, who played at UMass Lowell, 6'7 kid. We had a 1,000-point scorer, Chris Moxley, who went on to Heidelberg and scored 1,000 points there. So we see them in the district final. And, I mean, talk about playing like your C game. We were down like 20-4, and I'm like, oh my gosh, the ball cannot go in that orange circular thing for us. And they end up beating us and going to the Final Four. And oddly enough, their coach, Don Wurzel, was from Marion. And he, about a week or so after the tournament run, he resigned and he took the Marion Harding job. And the word on the street in Columbus was Bishop Reedy's going to be down. They got nobody coming back. Again, not as glamorous as it looks because they just went to the Final Four. And my take, kind of being from Northeast Ohio, but living in Columbus for a long period of time, Columbus jobs are really hard to come by, just in general. It's a growing city. It's an attractive place to live. And that goes into the education coaching field. So I threw all my eggs in that basket. And I networked with people who were within our educational system there in Columbus, in the diocese, and through the coaching networks. And I got an interview and kind of found out through the pipeline that no really guys with head coaching experiences were really going for the job. And, I'm like, yeah, it's a kind of a rival school. So there was that awkward piece really to it. But I'm like, you know what? I'm a Catholic school background guy. I really want to do this. If they offer me the job, if I'm serious about really being a head coach at the high school level, let's go, So sure enough, I was fortunate to get hired in May of 2014. And my wife and I went from Canal Winchester on the east side to Grove City on the west side of Columbus. And then we made Bishop Reedy our home.
What did you take away from your time as an assistant that you were able to apply as a head coach? Question number one. And then two, what did you think it was going to be like being a head coach versus what the experience actually was like in your first, let's say, 60 days, if you remember?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I could write a book about my first 6 months at least, but 60 days is good too. So you have to realize that when you're, you could sort of call me like the associate head coach, top assistant, at Hartley in my last year. You have to realize that the win-loss record isn't on my name. So when we installed like a ball screen role, European, ball screen offense, we felt like it fit our personnel well. Well, if that would have collapsed, yeah, Quartercracks would have been pretty upset with me. But at the same time, he would have, I can learn from that and be fine. So I had the experimental lab work without necessarily as many repercussions. I obviously took pride in that, but I wanted it to go well. But I was also able, he really gave me the keys to run our youth program and try to get kids attracted to Reedy, excuse me, to Hartley. So I started a summer league at Hartley, where we basically had one gym, but we tried to get two nights a week where we had 4-hour windows, and we made teams in the 7th and 8th grade, and the assistant coaches coached, and it's almost like it's a little mini, you know, city league, but it was done by a Catholic school, and it went, you know, swimmingly well. You know, people loved it, got relationships with the kids. So I get hired at Hartley, at Reedy the very next late spring in May. And at Reedy, well, I'm going to do the same thing, you know? So day one of the job, after meeting the kids, which was great, you know, you really want kids. I think the day I got the job, I took some good advice. You want to give them something like, here's who we're going to be. Here's what we're going to do together. And this isn't really about Dan DeCrane. It's about Bishop Reedy basketball. And we're just a piece of that longstanding tradition of great coaches and players and success. So, you know, gave them something that we were going to kind of model ourselves after. And then, honestly, Mike, I went running on the floor to our Catholic feeder schools. And I'm like, hey, you know, here's who I am. I can't wait to meet you. So I started in like a 2 weeks time frame, like a summer league that had 19 kids in it. So we had to play 4-4. We only had one gym. Saturday nights and Monday nights, and this is kind of goes into our season, are bingo nights. So we can't even use the gym those evenings. So you're trying to find everything you can do to get your guys' time and your, you know, kind of getting with our community to see who wanted to become part of our, you know, hopefully basketball program one day. So needless to say, and then my wife would laugh at this too. We went to every single Catholic church festival with, you know, the blue Bishop Reedy gear that we could find and just kind of meet people. And I didn't like act like I was the mayor, but I just wanted to say, hey, I can't wait to be, I am part of your, you know, community family, and here's who I am, and, you know, come check us out. And I was tired. I got home at 10 o'clock most nights. My wife and one kid at the time, two kids at the time, I can't even remember now, didn't see me very much. But at the end of the summer, I felt like, okay, we kind of put some foundation work together, kind of going forward, which, you know, led to a lot of good things there.
Did you, before you got the head coaching job, did you have a notebook, a computer file, a system for collecting things that you thought you would need or that you would use when you eventually became a head coach? Did you have that foresight when you were as an assistant coach to sort of start preparing for the time when you would have a head coaching job?
Yeah. And I don't call mine the coaching philosophies. I call mine the program. And it was basically, here's who I am. And it was certainly pieced together from tons of people I've been around. You know, me creating some of it, obviously, and the entire piece, but I just call it the program. And if I have, you know, if I'm fortunate enough to be offered this job, here's what I'm going to do. And it's still evolving. Like I added to it like last week after I was kind of wrapping up some things I did for the 2019-20 season at Gilmore. And yeah, I definitely had that and I modeled it, but then I learned quickly too, every school is different. Every, you know, team is different, but and you have to adapt to that to find success. I think people who adapt are going to be very successful. You can't be the same coach and do the same exact things you did 3 years ago and expect to have success. I'm not talking about morals and values, but just whether it's schemes, finding ways to connect with kids, growing your program in different, you know, avenues on and off the floor. And I started to do that a little bit on the fly at Reedy as I'm learning more and more about the environment that I'm in.
So what are some, let's take it this direction. What are some values that don't change no matter what year it is, no matter what program you take over, no matter what your kids are like? What are some things that you stand for as a coach from a value standpoint? Again, not talking about obviously schemes change, the game changes, your personnel changes, and so then you make adjustments within that. But I'm guessing that there are some core things that you believe in that you're still going to believe in 10 years from now and that you believed in 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, 100%. And we had what we called the Reedy way when I was at Reedy, and we had 6 core principles. And when I got to Gilmore, I feel like sometimes, you know, when there's more than five things, it's you know, it gets sort of twisted and goes in different branches, which is good. So I kind of try to condense them into four. And the first one was family. I just feel like anything you do in life that's going to be meaningful, worthwhile, successful, you find you get a lot out of it is with other people. And I think with that goes servant leadership and uplifting others and finding ways to connect with the people around you to make them better. Like that's a family, you know, and I have so much fun, you know, with our basketball family to teach them the game and the same thing that I do with, you know, coloring with my 3-year-old, you know, like that's, you know, trying to teach somebody something. So, you know, that kind of it really resonates with us. And another one is faith. You know, we're all in different areas of our faith life, and some of us might not believe they have one, but, you know, having faith in other people and trust and belief. And obviously I'm able to do that in my Catholic faith in the schools that I've been fortunate enough to coach at, but having faith in the power above and God and finding us answers to life's hard questions and our journey and our paths together. And then the other two that I sort of reshaped, maybe, if lack of a better term, is the first one's max effort. I always hear people like, hey, that's good effort. That's great effort. I had, you know, awesome effort today. And well, did you have maximum effort? Did you approach a conversation with a friend who's in need with, you know, tremendous effort, just as much as you did spraying the floor or studying for that chemistry test? So, you know, going through that with maximum effort, I think, is different than just going, hey, let's give out good effort today. Because you're going to get final, you know, I truly believe that hard work is just one ingredient of success. It's an important one. You have to have it, but you also have to do it, you know, I think full throttle, and you will get there. And the last one is, you know, it's the big T word, but it's toughness. And I, you know, being resilient, finding ways to persevere during hard times. And I just got off a Zoom call tonight with our guys kind of showing them some examples of that. And that's such a, it's so easy, especially nowadays, to see, woe is me, there's so many problems, so much going on. And it's finding the resiliency and the grit to kind of, you know, get through it in a positive way. So those are the four things I feel like right now I've tried to rally around as a coach and a leader of the basketball program.
All right. So as you're rallying your kids around those values, how do you go about instilling those in your team? Is it a process where you point out behaviors during practice, during games, and say that particular action that I just witnessed is what toughness to me is all about? Or that action in the locker room really shows me that you understand what family is all about. Is that how you do it, is kind of defining behaviors or attaching behaviors that you can then recognize in your kids to those values? Or is there some other way that you try to impart it and get it across to your players?
Yeah, we do a multitude of things. And to answer your question directly with the examples you're giving, Mike, yeah, we definitely highlight things that kids do. And we had three players this year who won a business award that they did with their landscaping business model. And it was just an initiative that they took on, that they grew. So finding things that kids are doing productively on and off the court, you know, through their service work. We had a couple kids who we did a homeless veterans initiative where we raised our freshman coach, Randy Keller, helped us lead, you know, raising funds and just basic goods for homeless veterans in the Cleveland area. And a lot of kids jumped on that. We did a Black History Month project where kids had to research, team up with another teammate and research that and conduct that. And we have a Special Olympics team that coaches that we coach at the Mayfield Lancers, who coach Funside Start. And we have coaches and kids have specific roles with that. But, and we highlight things on the court too, obviously. You know, I started showing more of our bench during big plays to the kids and guys standing up and cheering and getting touches. And I did things happening on the court, I felt like, the last couple of weeks of the season, because it was so important. It just shows guys that guy 15 didn't play at all, but he was so invested in what we did. And I thought we had a great, you know, second half of the season because of that. But I think a bigger thing that I did about 5 years ago was I developed a curriculum to kind of teach life lessons through our program. And we call it Squire Sessions. And I got the term because I was trying to find things to be creative, I guess. But a squire is a medieval term for a knight in training. And at Reedy, we were the Bishop Reedy Silver Knights. Ironically, I was the Hoban Knight back in the day. And then now I'm a Lancer, which is kind of like
there seems to be a theme here, an odd theme running through this, Dan.
Yeah, exactly. So we have topics where we literally kind of teach lessons. Sometimes it's like a PowerPoint. Sometimes it's a group activity. Sometimes it's a video discussion or a service project, like I said, where we do things like, you know, we teach positive psychology and what it means to be happy and the mindset that goes into it. I mentioned resiliency. So we had a social issues discussion 3 weeks ago together about what's been going on in our world. The perseverance story we shared tonight was the Kevin Atlas story. And just so, you know, that kind of stuff, I think you can't just say, hey, we teach kids things without showing kind of like a lesson plan, you know, And so we kind of have a model that, you know, quite honestly, Mike, I wish I had more time to keep doing more of these things. At Reedy, and I'll give you an example, too, of how it was different at Reedy. You know, I felt like some of our kids' backgrounds were a little bit different at Reedy. And kids are kids. 14, 18-year-olds they're growing. They're inconsistent at times. They're, you know, they have different agendas, different goals and aspirations. And you're trying to, again, get a group of guys to come together. But the backgrounds that kids at Reedy were different. So we were teaching kids how to cut hair and change tires. Not because they're going to do that one day, but just because, you know, we felt like it was important for them to learn those things. Certainly Gilmore guys got to learn how to change a tire too. If they get pulled over off the highway. But we felt like with the group of kids we have, what are they going to get, you know, the best out of from the program that we wanted to start? So
absolutely. I think that what I hear you saying is something that goes to a lot of the conversations that I've been able to have on the podcast when coaches talk about life lessons or they talk about anything specific to their coaching. And that is that it's really, really important for you to be intentional. And what I hear you talking about when you're saying about the community service things you're doing and about the life lessons that you're trying to teach and instilling the values in your kids and pointing out behaviors, all that stuff based on the fact that you're putting together the Squire program is done intentionally. And I'm sure that that's something that you have to continuously go back and remind yourself of, hey, I got to be looking out for those things. I know I've said this myself a few times on the podcast that there'll be times for me as a coach where I'll get excited about something and I may do it for a week or 2 weeks. And then I'll lose my focus as a coach and I'll move on to the next thing. And then this thing that 2 weeks ago I was so excited about sometimes gets pushed away. And what I find is I have to be very, very intentional in my planning and in my thought process going into practice or going into a game or going into a meeting, whatever it may be, to make sure that I'm focused on the right things and I'm being intentional in teaching the things that I want to teach. And so maybe just talk a little bit about how you go about being intentional in your day with your kids, practice, in whatever setting it is that you're interacting with them.
Yeah. And we're definitely in the, you got to show me, not tell me era, right?
For sure. Like,
and that's, I think, a big part of it. So obviously I have to be excited about whether it's a practice drill or a thing we're doing off the court. Otherwise it's not going to, the kids aren't going to buy into it. They're not going to go for it, but they have to see the tangible results to things too. And so something that I think maybe sets us apart a little bit to teaching these things and instilling some stuff on the court is we have a unique leadership role where everyone on my varsity team is a captain. And they're not all – they don't all go out at the 17-minute mark and shake hands with the officials and the other team captains. We have 2 to 3 kids paired up, and they're leading different parts of our program. Because, again, going back to the Squire stuff is – You can't just say, hey, go be a leader. Hey, you're a captain. What does that mean? You know, it's just a title if you don't show kids what to do. So we have a coach assigned. You know, they get one or two of these captains groups. And so our captains are split up on – we have weight room captains. We have practice captains. We have like a spirit faith formation captain. We have game day captains who you would typically see at the center court. We have – a locker room captains who are responsible for the climate and physical appearance of the locker room, home and away. So I feel like kids could grow in certain roles because to me, you're either impacting somebody positively or negatively. You know, Adolf Hitler, unbelievable leader, you know, a dangerous one, certainly a negative one, responsible for millions of deaths. but he led millions of people to do something. You know, Muhammad Gandhi, unbelievable leader, right? Mother Teresa. I mean, we can name Martin Luther King. We can name so many people. It's the power of yourself and how you're going to impact those around you. So, you know, at practice, I feel like kind of, you know, tying basketball a little bit to it is, you know, you gotta be connected. You know, I really get on my guys when we're not cheering and clapping for each other in drills, if you're not directly involved to it. So we have certain, you know, whistle commands and claps where I get their attention, but I expect their energy level to increase because of that. You know, so, but you have to reinforce those positive habits. You know, life's all about creating healthy habits, and same thing with basketball, right? So the things we're doing now, but the things we do in practice, they're going to trickle onto a game. And just so, you know, you can't be good at everything. I get that. But some of the culture stuff, because I believe culture is, you know, intentional behaviors that you're trying to, you know, that you naturally perform. And we're trying to create positive and uplifting behaviors. So, like I said, whether it, you know, if it's clapping during our, you know, Villanova passing up and down drill, or it's, you know, when a guy takes a charge, all five guys go and run to pick him up. Like, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, we're trying to instill video on the court in games, practices, you know, to represent Gilmore Academy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you do those kinds of things and you're intentional about them, you end up being much more likely to get the kind of results that you want to get. Let's shift to some more basketball specific questions. And first one I'll start out with is, what is something nerdy, for lack of a better word, basketball nerdy about coaching that you love that maybe somebody might not know about you just from knowing you, not in a not deeply and being able to be in your practices or be part of your coaching staff? What's a nerdy basketball thing that you really love about coaching?
Oh, man. About coaching specifically. You know, I just think the history of high school basketball. So right now I have like six, no, maybe more than that, probably 10 different windows up. And like six of them are on the Ohio high school basketball tournament history, statistics. And I did this when I was growing up. I remember opening up the Akron Beacon Journal every Wednesday because they had their power ranking polls and the box scores from the Tuesday night games. And I just remember, you know, names, scores, you know, what teams were good. So I think what I try to do now as a coach is how that's kind of related to who I am now is, you know, I'm constantly on Twitter and, like I said, you know, different websites looking up coaching changes to, you know, the 92 Gilmore state title team who lost to Berlin Highland and what Berlin Highland, you know, player was on there because, you know, who's coaching on that. You know, I just do really weird, strange things with maybe coaching and playing and program trees, I think, in the state of Ohio. I think Ohio's so underrated in sports in our country. You know, you talk about the athletes in Florida, California, Texas, and there's so many good players. To answer your question fully too, Mike, we did two basketball trivia nights during COVID-19 with our high school kids. And one of my categories was OHSA history. And one night was individual and one night was team records. And the kids,
do your kids know anything?
Well, they got so mad at me because, like, I kind of warned them that some of the questions were probably pretty hard and, you know, like, you know, who's, you know, Mr. Basketball or whatever. You know, they got the LeBron questions right, kind of, but they struggle with everything else, you know. I think they got St. John's Arena right. And,
okay.
You know, so that kind of stuff is just
really cool.
Yeah.
That's fun. That's funny. Just one thing when you were talking that jumped out at me is when you talked about how you used to pore over the box scores in the Akron Beacon Journal. And that's one of the things that now, if you want to find a high school box score, it is like brutal to try to sort through the various websites and somehow try to get to a box score. That's one of the things that I remember I missed so much as the newspaper coverage started to go away. Even today, as a guy who doesn't coach high school basketball, but just it was so much easier and more convenient to be able to just flip open the sports page on Saturday morning and flip through and just see the scores from the various teams. And you could keep track of, oh, I've looked at this Shaker Heights box score 5 games in a row, and this kid's had over 20 points every game. He must be pretty good. And then maybe you start to follow that particular player a little bit more and just kind of pay attention to him. And I think it's much – you have to be a serious, serious fan of high school basketball in general to be able to follow the game in the same way. It takes a lot more, I think, effort, which is kind of strange when you think about it, that the internet has made so much more information accessible. And yet I feel like local sports coverage is so much more difficult to find in a lot of ways.
Oh, I mean, we'll look at the Youngstown, the Vindicator, you know, they stopped, right?
Right.
So you're losing media outlets. And then you got to pay, you got to subscribe and pay for online stuff so much. So you can't, you know, like you mentioned, with the lack of box scores. And I knew coaches 6 years ago, they'd cut out box scores and keep them. And I try to save a lot of that data for their scattering reports.
Right.
You know, so, and that's gone. You know, it's funny. We kind of just were talking about kind of connecting coaches and history. So this is about 2.5 months ago during COVID. I'm online on a Saturday morning and I see a special story run. It's late March because it was right after the tournament got canceled. And the only Mahoning Valley or Mahoning County, Mahoning Valley, Mr. Basketball was Bobby Patton Jr. in 1990. Well, they did a special. One of the news stations did a special on him, and it was like 15 minutes long, and they showed big games he played in. You know, this one, like, it was crazy. Like, a district semifinal ended in a fight. And, you know, so anyway, where I'm going with this, in the Final Four, they beat Bishop Hartley. And the Bishop Hartley coach at the time was Sam Davis, who was a longtime coach at New Albany. And I know Sam Davis really well, so I call Sam Davis up, and I'm like, you got to check this out. Like, there's a, you know, 35-year-old version of yourself because he's right in his 60s now. I mean, that kind of stuff was cool. But you're right. It's so hard to find that now, you know.
And it is.
It kind of takes away a lot from the high school, like that tradition of pageantry we're talking about.
Absolutely. I think you just – I remember as a high school player and then as a young adult and going back and still trying to follow it and reading the articles and learning more about, you know, what games the Plain Dealer is going to be covering. You knew those were going to be the big games, and you'd see the five or six games on Saturday morning that Eddie Dwyer would be at the game, and you knew it was a big game because Eddie was there. And just it's just a different world today when it comes to high school basketball, and in so many different ways, which I'm sure you can attest to some of the changes and the way things are going. And so let's take it that direction. I referenced it a little bit earlier, just in terms of the amount of time that you have to put in as a high school coach. So talk a little bit about maybe not so much your in-season workload, but just talk a little bit about, obviously this is not a normal summer, but in a normal summer, just maybe give us an idea of some of the things that you do in your program to help your kids get better and what an average summer might look like in terms of the time commitment that you're putting in.
Yeah, sure. So some things in the last couple of weeks have changed for us, what our school's allowing us to do. But I honestly, I think June's my busiest month of the year. You know, from youth camps during the days, you know, to what I used to have summer leagues when I ran those at Reedy, and I used to only have one gym too then, to getting our high school guys practices with a 10-day, you know, rule period, and making, you know, wise use of those, to the incoming freshmen and getting those kids acclimated, to then having, you know, summer leagues and summer shootouts we were at. And then I always believe that if one of my players, especially who's an upperclassman, going to be junior or senior, if he's getting recruited or wants to play at a particular college and level, I want to make sure he gets seen in our team setting in front of those colleges. So I try to schedule, you know, our shootouts at some of those colleges to take our guys to, which is good for everybody, but especially for that particular, you know, player. And so that all happens in June. So, you know, a typical day in June will be, you know, get my kids. Fortunately, they can go to camp with me at Gilmore right now with the certain summer programs they have. But it's get up at 5:15. I usually get about an hour of, you know, quote unquote, quiet time with my coffee and whether I'm doing basketball research or responding to emails. And then it's, you know, get to the gym, and it's, you know, youth camp from 8 to about 4, 8:30. Right now it's about 8:30 to 2. And then it's workouts for our guys. Typically it'd be, you know, lifting, you know, possibly with another coach, maybe in the morning or afternoon. Fortunately, we have a strength and conditioning coach at Gilmore too, in case the coach can't be there. But it's lifting with those guys, getting to make sure they're getting their work. And if they're not lifting for a fall sport, because I have fall sport athletes do their strength program. And then it's, you know, if it's a four-man workout if it's a coaching day, we're going to have a full, 90-minute to 2-hour practice into maybe a summer league game that night, so we don't have to, lose a coaching day, so to speak. And it's, last year we were in 2 summer leagues, so sometimes they're on the same night, so we're kind of traveling to different parts of the Cleveland area to play in those. And it's getting home at, not right now, but 9 o'clock at night. Not right now. I can kind of get our workouts done since there's different rules this summer with COVID-19 a little bit earlier. But you're doing that, during the week, and then maybe a Saturday shootout from June 1 through, really the 4th of July. It's kind of when things start to change, and then we kind of turn over to small group workouts. We do a lot of 4-man workouts. We can get a lot of reps in and teach, footwork a little bit more, specifically, or work on a player's weakness more in a one-on-one setting. And like I said, if there's a baseball player, we got a football guy who wants to come in after his football left, like I'm always willing to, work with kids to make sure they get time with me or another coach on the floor. So yeah, it's a full week. It's a full summer.
Tell us a little bit about your youth camp and how that fits into you being able to build your program at Gilmore.
Yeah. So Gilmore, we've been blessed to have Sean O'Toole as our athletic director, and he came on board in 2016 and was an assistant for David Funstein for, a couple of years before I got hired. And then his role shifted to full-time being the athletic director full-time. So, I inherited some coaches and brought some new ones in. But one thing that Sean's done for, I think he's going on his 27th, 28th year, is big shot basketball. And to me, that was an attractive piece because, to be honest, Mike, at Reedy, we really felt like as much of success and tradition that they had, when I got hired, I felt like we really had to kind of make this a grassroots, build it from the ground up program because we weren't going to have success at the varsity level right away. So I spent, hours upon hours of communication, marketing, our camps and summer leagues that I started. Well, Sean does that. So, that's one of his businesses, and it's a successful one at that. So I'm able to be a face and, hands-on with the kids on the floor, and the organization and the structure and direction come from a great basketball mind and a great person who cares about kids. So, and obviously he's got a name and a strong reputation in the basketball world. So I'm able to kind of co-join that rather than have to kind of start my own. And like I said earlier, every program's different. If I had a head job in another part of the city or another area, I'd have to work differently, so it was adaptable for that. And honestly, it's nice for me because, with a young family, I can kind of be more, I can spend my manpower hours, I should say, differently,
Understood. Talk a little bit about the relationship between you and Sean, just how you guys, if you knew each other before you got the job, and then how the relationship has built up. Obviously you have the athletic director coach relationship, but you also have his son playing for you on the team. So talk a little about that parent coach relationship and just what Sean has meant to you in terms of you having success there at Gilmore.
Sure. Sure. So I didn't know Sean a whole heck of a lot. We joked actually this past week when I was at Akron East, he was the head coach at Ignatius, and their freshman played ours. And I remember meeting him in the corner of the gym, and we were kind of joking about that. And other than that, I coached against him at Ed's the year before. I was one of the 20 coaches on the Ed's staff, and obviously he wasn't going to know me from anybody else. But I applied for the Gilmore job in the spring of 2018. And with our growing family and my wife and I both from Northeast Ohio, we were looking for opportunities to come back home. And I was only going to do it for the right job. And I kind of felt Gilmore was a transformational place. Not just for me, but for the product it can produce for a kid, a student athlete especially too. So it was attractive, yeah. And I reached out to some people, and its Catholic founding is by the Holy Cross Brothers, who are also connected with Hoban and St. Edward's. So I had people at both schools who knew me, who knew Sean. So they reached out to Sean, and I applied for the job. And the administration didn't know me as well, but I was fortunate enough to get an interview, and it was kind of later on, it was in the middle of June, kind of the thick of obviously basketball camps, and they hadn't had a coach for 2 months, and they had a lot of success. And when David stepped down, Coach Funstein stepped down, they had a great backcourt, as we had CJ Charleston and Connor O'Toole and other really talented players, you know, guys were ready to go, you know. So I got hired in the middle of June, and Sean and I had talked maybe daily on his way home from camp at night, and I got to know him really well that way before I even got hired. And then as soon as I got there, you know, Sean's a great guy, and I knew our relationship with, like anything, takes time to grow. So, you know, I have different ideas, you know, different things I do. And, you know, kind of realizing maybe for the first time in Connor's life, a really talented player, great young man, his dad's not going to coach him in high school, you know, in a school setting, because his dad was always his coach, you know. So just showing him, you know, the family, everybody at Gilmore, you know, who I was as a person, and a lot of things I had mentioned, like, you know, here's who I, this is what I'm going to do. And I think he appreciated that. And then, you know, but words don't speak as much as actions do. So just showing that on a day-to-day basis, and but also having a basketball mind to rely on, you know. And sometimes I'll walk in his office and he'll be more pumped for our upcoming year or the game, and like, hey, you guys, we're ready, you guys are great, you know, than I am. Like, I'm like worried sick, you know. He's like, yeah,
right.
And but just that's an assurance thing, you know. It gives me confidence. Like, okay, you know, he sees what we're doing. He's had a lot of success at a lot of other places, and obviously at Ignatius and Euclid before. So, hey, that's a good thing. So, you know, bouncing ideas off him is awesome. And it, you know, like, you know, the director of the GCBCA and District 2, and you know, having someone that's going to be on your side like that is just a huge asset. You know, just not just for our program, but for me as a head coach.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only imagine. Had you been in the facilities at Gilmore before you came up to interview?
So my cousin got married at Gilmore's chapel in 2009. And it was right when they were finishing the gym. I remember it was in the wintertime. So I walked by and I peeked my head and I'm like, this place is incredible. And then by year at Ed's, we played at Gilmore in their field house because their main gym was not done yet. And you couldn't really see anything, but you know, so it's so ironic, Mike, at Reedy, Reedy has redone their floor the year after I left. Reedy's floor was about 35 years old. One of my assistants and I twice a week would take a block, a hammer, and pound in the nails back into the wood. And the wood was down to its nubs. They couldn't really put a finish on it anymore. So I was begging our administration at the time, and I know funds are tighter, and every school is different, but just to kind of give you the visual of what it was like, of where I was at. And then you walk into, I'm not trying to be biased, but it's one of the best game playing facilities I've seen in the state of Ohio.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's just gorgeous, just modern and gorgeous. And I joke with my assistants too. I feel like our opponents shoot too well in the gym. It's like a shooter's gym. Like there's, you know, it's a great place to play for everybody, not just our guys. So, but no, it's unbelievable. You know, it's immaculate. They did a great job with the spacing. Obviously it sits low with the high ceilings and the windows and the lighting. I mean, it's a neat place to be. It really is.
Yeah, it's a fantastic facility for anybody who is in the Cleveland area, who's been there. You know, realize what a special facility is. If you haven't been, it's worth your time. And I joke that I spent, whatever, 13 or 14 years coaching at Richmond Heights and playing Gilmore every single year. And we always played in the old gym where you would sit and there was – it was like old Cleveland Municipal Stadium where you would sit and half the bench would be on one side of the pillar. And it was just, you know, this tiny cramped little space. And my last year of coaching must have been 2008, maybe 2009. So it must have been right before construction began on the new facility. And then for a long time, my kids were little. I wasn't coaching anymore. So I never made it over there. And I don't think I even realized that a new gym had been built. And so at some point a couple of years ago, my son had an AAU tournament and we were playing out at Gilmore. And I walked into that place and I was like, oh my God, like I couldn't even wrap my head around the fact that you still obviously had the field house, which I remember. And then, you know, but the old gym is gone and here you have this beautiful, unreal arena-like setting where there used to be this tiny bandbox of a gym where I would have to sit behind a pillar as an assistant coach. And it just blew my mind. It's really, honestly, I think you're 100% spot on that it's one of the most beautiful facilities and places to play basketball. I can't imagine a better high school court, high school environment, high school arena, however you want to phrase it, than what you guys have there at Gilmore. And I'm sure that's a huge attraction to be able to get players and kids to enroll.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's a statement. Even to me, when I was applying for the job, you know, it shows like, hey, you know, because to me, an athletics are an extension of the classroom. You know, wouldn't you want to have a nice classroom? You know, it's the same thing with the gym to me, and they're doing other stuff too. If you go back, Mike, like there's turf baseball field. I mean, brand new, you know, stadium type seating there. I mean, it's just awesome. And yeah, obviously, it's something that can sell itself. And I didn't have a lot of opportunities. The last couple stops that necessarily had that. So this was a great, you know, huge, you know, kind of coin in the pocket for this job for me.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. Dan, we're coming up close to an hour and a half, and it's been a lot of fun getting a chance to talk to you, get a chance to learn more about what makes you tick and how you've built your programs. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can get in touch with you, share your social media handles, what the best way is for people to reach out if they have questions or they just want to say hello. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Sure. Yeah. So my Twitter handle, my personal one is at Coach DeCrane. That's DeCrane. If, you know, anyone can feel free to, you know, DM me or send me a message. And my email, Gilmore, is DeCraneD@gilmore.org. That's GILMOUR.org. And yeah, you know, this has been an absolute blast, Mike. And if there's anything I can to help or reach out, and thank you guys for growing the game. This stuff is just, it's gold to me. And hopefully, you know, someone can get maybe something small out of my story tonight. But I appreciate the opportunity tonight.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate the kind words. We're definitely trying to do the best we can to bring on great guests like yourself and people who have done amazing things in the game of basketball, and people who care about the game and want to see it get better, people who care about the kids they're coaching. And to me, that's really what our mission is all about here on the Hoopheads Pod, is just being able to give people a platform who care about the game and are trying to do good things. And we appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule and away from your family, even though your kids are sleeping. And, you know, it's still is nice of you to take the time and join us. So, to everyone out there, we appreciate you listening to us, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics, so you can now purchase 3 of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store, and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball, Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.